Hello, everyone, and welcome to Minute 7 of Season 5 of Movie Rob Minute, the daily podcast where we yippee-ki-yay our way through the 1990 Bruce Willis action film Die Hard 2, Die Harder, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again today is Josh Horowitz of the Hello. 12 Times It's Midnight, 5 Minutes of Trouble, and 5 Minutes of Banzai. Welcome back, Josh.
Oh, I'm glad to be back, Rob.
Yeah, I'm glad after yesterday's long episode, you decided to still come back. You know, that I didn't deter you. You know, just grab those tools, will you?
Yeah.
Right. So you asked me, you know, in the green room, if you can actually introduce the starting and ending points of this minute. So go ahead. I'll let you do it.
Yes. We are on minute 7 of Die Hard 2. Die Harder. Yes. Minute 7 starts with John strolling down memory lane with Colonel Stewart. And it ends with Matlock walking out on some quality TV. You got to admit, he does look like him.
Yes, he definitely does. He definitely does. We'll get there tomorrow. Actually, tomorrow we'll talk about who that actor is, because today he doesn't get anything to say. So, you know, I usually introduce a character once they have something to say. But we'll get there. So yes, we ended things yesterday with John bumping into Stewart, getting the two of them to actually, you know, interact at some point. You know, at an early stage of the movie. I mean, come on. They're interacting at the end of 6 and the beginning of 7 minutes, you know, so pretty quick for the two of them to meet each other, even though neither one of them has any clue that they are adversaries at this point.
No, that's right.
And so, you know, John bumps into him and says, "Excuse me." And then John continues and says, "Well, you look really familiar to me." And then Stewart responds, "I get that a lot. I've been on TV." You know, it's just very strange that that's the way the two of them would respond like this. You know, here, Stewart
two celebrities.
Is supposed, no, I know that, but Stewart is supposed to be like a Ollie North type of character or something like that. I don't think that that's the type of thing he would say by saying, "Oh yeah, I've been on TV." You know.
Well, I wonder if he said something different, actually, because if you look, here's another pretty bad dubbing that's happening. I mean, my thought is that there must have been a lot of loud noise at the airport, so they had to have a lot of these redubbing sessions during this.
Right. Well, we'll have to wait until the end of this minute to find out if you know what's in the script, because I mean, I didn't mention this yesterday, but the "excuse me" actually came from Stewart in the script.
Ah.
You know, even though here it sounded yesterday as if it was McLean who actually said it. But again,
right. Well, I wasn't sure. So maybe they did record it that way.
Yes, it could be. And then John's response is, "Yeah, me too." It's just a little strange response that people would have to this type of thing. You know, it's like even if they are somewhat, you know, famous for what they've been doing. I don't know. I just don't think that that would necessarily be the type of response because, you know, John is supposed to be somewhat humble in what's going on here. So he's not necessarily going to, you know, point out the fact that you know, he's from that Nakatomi thing that happened. And Stewart is supposedly here in a covert capacity. So, you know, to even give a hint as to where someone might know who he is sort of letting the cat out of the bag here.
Well, I think it's a funny response line from Willis's character, but here's a sense where it's also true.
Yes.
He is on TV.
That is true.
Or has been.
He, on Moonlighting, you mean. Or Nightline, as they'll talk about later, but whatever. And I mean, the funny thing is they have both of these characters, you know, give like a long look at the other one, trying to figure out where they know them from.
Yes. You know, you even have an ominous stare.
That's right. We even have Stewart walk away and then turn around and look back and say, "Who was that masked man?" You know, that type of thing.
So do you think he knows at this point who John is?
You know, that was a question I was about to ask you.
Yeah.
I have a feeling he has no clue.
Yeah, probably not. He's putting some mental memory at this point.
That's right.
You know, he's gonna remember him for later.
Yes, I think so. I don't think he really does recognize him though. He might say this guy seems a little familiar, but I don't know from where.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know.
Indeed. Who is that masked man?
That's right. And then the shot changes, and we see a church.
Or yeah, it's Norman Rockwell-esque, isn't it?
Very. We have a great crane shot that starts really high and like moves down, and we get to see this area covered with snow.
You know, I could have sworn that I've had a 1,000 piece puzzle that's looked just like this.
Could be. Could be, but I mean,
where was this filmed though? Was this in Michigan?
No, this actually, Rennie Harlan talks about this on the commentary that this was filmed, I believe. Actually, I'm trying to remember where he said it, but he said when they got there was no snow whatsoever. This is entirely fake snow. It was in the winter, yeah. but there was no snow. So they
reading somewhere about that. Yeah.
Yes, they had a lot of trouble in the movie with this. This was not in Michigan. Michigan was when where the plane lands, I think, was done in Michigan. Uh-huh. And then parts of it was also filmed in Denver, and then most of the interiors were filmed in L.A.
That would explain my next question then
about Pacific Bell.
They're creating the snow each time, because the next shot that we're going to see, I mean, there's like untouched fresh snow on the ground, and then they have this one take crane shot, you know, where they go back and then you see the car going over it and stuff. So I was just wondering, what did they literally just do that in one take and it was perfect, or did they have people refreshing the snow? So I guess
I don't know. He doesn't mention about how many takes they needed to do this. But I found it very interesting. I mean, look outside. This looks like it's getting close to dusk, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So I looked up when dusk was in Washington, D.C. Yesterday we talked a little bit about the fact that this probably takes place on the tail end of December 1989. So if it takes place on the 21st or the 22nd, okay, then sunset was at 4:50.
Mm-hmm.
And then if it takes place on Saturday, sunset is at 4:51. The only reason I'm mentioning this is because later in the week, we're going to talk a little bit more about time. So, you know, everyone make mental notes of when dusk is. You know, this looks like it's getting very close to dusk. Whether, you know, it's not dark yet. So,
yeah, I mean, from the previous shots in the airport, at first glance, I thought it was already nighttime.
That's right.
It's hard to tell.
Exactly. That's true. This was.
It's okay, because we're caught up in the movie, you see,
yes.
Rob.
Of course.
So we don't care about any of these time inconsistencies.
Of course not. But when we do this minute by minute, we do.
I know.
I love it.
Never watch the film the same ever again.
I of the four movies that I've already done, whenever I've rewatched them, I see them in a totally different light now. You know, completely. Because, you know, I've discussed them endlessly. What can I say? So, I mean, I'm assuming when you watch... you know, either Buckaroo Banzai or Big Trouble in Little China, you see them very different now also, don't you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Okay, exactly.
Interestingly, that I think I appreciated both films maybe a little bit more, having delved in so closely. But I think I liked Big Trouble in Little China more because of it. It was kind of – I still think that Buckaroo Banzai is a more difficult film to really take to.
Mm-hmm.
Then when you look at it really closely, you can kind of see exactly why.
Yes.
But can happen.
That's true. So if you look carefully on the, you know, when the shot comes down and the van is moving close into the front of the church. Okay. Mm-hmm. So you see two signs. Okay. One side, it says closed, which is like written very, very strangely. You know, it's not like it's like someone took a magic marker and wrote closed on it.
It's folksy.
Yes. Yeah. And then on the other side, what it seems like it says is Highland Lake Daycare Center.
Yes,
okay, you
there is.
Can't really read the rest of it. Okay. Now I looked up where Highland Lake is. Okay, because this is, I mean, a little spoiler for anyone who hasn't watched this whole movie yet. This is supposed to take place relatively close to the airport.
Right.
Okay, so Highland Lake is 43 miles away from Dulles. It's 24 miles from Thurgood Marshall Airport in Baltimore. It's 3 miles from Ronald Reagan Washington National Airport and 43 miles from Dulles. So I don't know if Highland
Lake.
Well,
maybe it's an unincorporated borough of.
Yes, it could be.
In this area.
It's very possible. It's very possible. I just thought it was very interesting. I was trying to, you know, find where does Highland Lake take place. Now, it's very possible also that Highland Lake is referring to something that takes, you know, maybe some Denver, like I said, or, you know, somewhere else. Doesn't really make a difference. But
and you notice that there's some children's equipment too. So yes, they have a daycare, or at least they did,
or they're going to be having a daycare, because I think it says future home.
It
says something home of Highland Lake Daycare Center, and you can't really read what it says underneath. I mean, the script will give us a little bit more insight into that when we get to that at the end of the minute.
That's more tragedy.
Yes,
they may not be able to have their goal of a daycare center.
Possibly not. Yeah, but also, like, you have the battered truck outside, you know, that the custodian uses, and there's like a little shack that looks somewhat disheveled also. So, you know, it doesn't look as if it's something that's very usable, I guess you can say, or who knows. What can I tell you? Then the van stops in front. And then we see someone get out on the passenger side, and we hear him say, "Grab the tools, will ya?" And you hear a response, "You got it." And then you hear the other door slam. Okay, it's
orange suited guys.
Yes. Now my biggest question is okay, these two guys were about to find out tomorrow that they are not really public works people. All right, but why are they having this type of conversation? You know, since this is a complete fabrication. You know, like, why do they need to play that out? Why don't they just say, you know, I mean, all right, because I know who the characters are. This is Baker and Thompson. Okay, so why are Baker and Thompson talking as if they're, you know, why doesn't he grab the tools? Why doesn't he just say, let's go in?
They're clearly, you know? Clearly, they're method actors.
Apparently. No, because there's no one else around. You know, it's like, you know, he could just say, you know, Thompson, make sure to bring your stuff. You know, it doesn't need to be, did you get your, you grab the tools, you know?
Well, or maybe the tools are, you know, some
are
hardware
weapons
that they normally, yes.
It could
there
be.
You go.
All right, that is possible. Yeah. That is possible. Mm-hmm. Right. So the two of them get out. They're wearing these orange suits, jumpsuits.
Yeah,
with,
orange.
With, yeah.
I had a little note about that one. So I looked up on an electrical blog, and apparently orange symbolizes hazard or caution, which is ideal for visibility in high-risk environments,
okay,
as opposed to wearing, I guess, yellow. So it kind of makes sense that if they are electricians, maybe wearing orange suits. And my other note is that you would think that the custodian in the church would have recognized this, that hazard and caution is warranted.
Yeah, he's too busy with the stack of newspapers next to him. You know, because after they make this comment, you know, the shot changes. We're inside of the church. We see the custodian sitting there on a chair, which it doesn't look like he's sitting very comfortably because his knees are really, really high up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's like sinking back a little bit, but he's drinking something. We're not sure what he's drinking, but he does have a can of Pepsi on his side. On the left hand side,
placement.
Yes, and behind that we see a few coffee mugs. We see a jar of Maxwell House, so that's where he keeps his coffee. And then on the right hand side of him, which is the left hand side of what we're looking at, obviously, there's a chair behind him that has a stack filled with newspapers. You know, so apparently he doesn't have much time to read the paper. And then there's a newspaper right next to him also. And there's a bowl, which we don't know what's in that bowl. You know, we'll find out soon, but we don't yet know what's in the bowl. And he's basically,
what's in the bowl?
watching the news, and we hear on the TV, this is Amy Nichol live from Escalon Airport, where deposed General Ramon Esperanza has just arrived under heavy guard. The deposed dictator's mood seems jubilant. He is waving to the crowd. And then we hear knocking on the door, as if running for political office. Thousands of political prisoners, including the new president. There's no doubt he still has some ardent supporters, both here and abroad. So this is all going on as, you know, we hear this all in the background, even though it jumps back and forth. So, you know, as the news report is going, you know, we see that this custodian picks up the bowl and he starts to eat some sort of soup. And then, mm-hmm. you know, he hears the knock on the door. And then we see from the outside the two men standing at the door, okay, Baker and Thompson. So I'll quickly say who these two actors are who play them. So Baker is played by an actor named Tony Ganios. Sorry if I mm-hmm. mispronounced that. Born in 1959. He has 15 IMDb credits. The only one that really jumped out at me besides this movie is he was actually in all three Porky's movies. He played Meat.
Porky's?
Yes.
Oh.
He played
Classics.
Meat.
Classics.
That's right.
He played Meat. Oh, very good.
Yes. And Thompson is played by a man named Peter Nelson, who was also born in 1959, which means that both of them were approximately 30 when they filmed mm-hmm. this. He has 31. IMDb credits. Yeah. He was in V, you know, the both miniseries, mm-hmm. the first miniseries V.
Oh, V. Yes, v. yes, yes.
And then the sequel miniseries he was also in, and he was also in The Last Starfighter.
Oh.
So
I know that movie. I wonder exactly. what part he had in that one, if he was one of the aliens or
no, he was actually one of the people I think he played there was a certain part in the movie, you know, where it's all taking place in, you know, in their,
well, the trailer park area.
The trailer park. That's the word I was looking for. In the trailer park. So he, I believe, is one of the guys in the trailer park. Because weren't they supposed to, like, go away for some sort of, they were going to go on a camping trip or something like that with friends?
Yeah, so he's, like, one of the cowboy hat wearing, like,
yeah, he's
friends
Jack,
or something.
Jack
yeah.
Blake. Okay, it doesn't sound like an alien.
Okay.
So yeah, right. So he does have only 31 IMDb credits. Right. So you know, we get a shot of the two of them standing at the door with their jumpsuits and vests on, and then you know, we go back inside and get another shot of this custodian who looks like he's getting pretty annoyed that he's being disturbed while he's trying to watch this very important news report. You know, because I guess it's easier to watch the news report than have to, you know, actually read the newspapers next to him. Who knows?
And take a look at that TV as well. I mean,
yes.
that's a classic one, you know, the old black and white with the rounded screens and the dials, the circle antenna in the back.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
That's a TV that I remember my grandmother having, you know, just pretty old school stuff.
Yeah.
And this is supposed to be 1989 or so.
Yes.
So yeah, he is steeped in the past.
Yes.
This guy who looks like Matlock.
That's right. So he's really annoyed, and he actually, you know, takes out a handkerchief and wipes his mouth and nose from the soup, you know, as he gets up and starts walking over towards the, you know, towards the door, as we see a shot on TV of Esperanza, you know, in handcuffs, waving his hands you know, in the air, I guess trying to get some of that support.
Yeah. You know, I mean, the fact that he's watching the news and, you know, it's once again General Esperanza. I mean, this moves the story along. We saw that
yes.
earlier. But wouldn't it have been so much more entertaining if he'd been watching something else like
Matlock.
I don't know, or Lethal Weapon 2?
Yes, that's true. Well, there's only so much they could have
TV,
put in
right?
Lethal Weapon 2, you know.
Yeah.
You know, this isn't Planes, Trains, and Automobiles where John Hughes put a movie that hasn't a movie that he was in the middle of making, he put a scene in. You know, you
yeah.
have a scene from She's Having a Baby in Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, even though that hasn't been released yet. So,
oh, wow.
Yeah. So that's all I have to say about this minute. Do you have anything you want to say about the minute before we get into the script?
Well, I have some notes about Matlock, or at least this actor. I don't know if you want to save that for when he actually talks.
Yeah, well, why don't we save it for tomorrow then, if you don't mind.
That's fine. And then the other thing was the knock knock from the DWP. I noted that, yeah, I mean, even today they still knock on doors to check your meter, which seems a little strange considering how much time has passed since this. But, you know, why don't they have drones or wireless signals letting them know, you know, the meter's info? But no, they physically have to go and check the meter still.
Ah, okay. I thought you meant that you're surprised that they're knocking on the door as opposed to kicking the door in.
Yeah. Oh, no. They're method actors. Remember, they're really into this role. So they're dutifully doing their job.
Well, come on. They don't want to alert anyone that anything's going wrong. You know.
That's right. He might have an old-timey phone he could call.
That's true. where you have to actually – a rotary phone or something like that.
Or you have to crank it.
That's true. That's a very good point. All right, so the script has some great description here, and it adds a few little things in a little bit here and there. So, you know, McLean says to I'll go back a little bit to yesterday. Stewart says, "Excuse me." McLean goes, "Do I know you?" And then Stewart goes, I get that a lot. I've been on TV." McLean goes, "You and me both, pal. The hell with it." Then it says, "Now it's Stewart's turn to look at McLean oddly. Then he moves off. McLean looks after him, trying to place him, shrugs, heads for the bar." And then it says, "A little semi-rural church near the airport, charming until the subwoofer roar of a big jet screams by, practically in the little church's backyard. Now we notice the church is a little rundown, trim needing paint, sidewalk cracked, and a neat sign confirms our suspicions. Future site of Parish Daycare Center. Worship with us at our new church, 52 Kensington Road, Alexandria, Virginia." A DWP van pulls up, snow tires crunching on the driveway here. Two men, Baker and Thompson, get out in official DWP wardrobe. But we remember the trim bodies, trimmer hair, and remember those gift-wrapped packages, which one of these guys carries. Inside the church on the TV, the newscast continues, now back to the tropical airport. Esperanza is at the top of the steps, waving to the press like a triumphant hero, not a felon en route to prison. The plane doors close and it taxis down the runway, widened from the seat, which an elderly custodian is watching while he eats some instant soup. The doorbell rings. The custodian answers it. So, again, I like the way they do it in the movie. I think that works quite well.
Yeah, the script seems to do that, the transition to show how close it is to the airport, something that doesn't happen in this scene.
No, but we'll see that. We'll actually
may happen in a future scene.
That's right. We will see it later this week. Mm-hmm. But yes. So every Tuesday we have a segment that I do called Disaster Tuesday, which... Basically, you know, one of the things that happens in this movie is there is a plane crash. So I try to find some, I guess, notable plane crashes that have happened, you know, and just discuss them a little bit, you know, a little bit of the details about what actually happened. And what I try and do, if possible, is talk about something that is, I guess, somewhat close geographically to where my guest is from. So because I know that Josh is from the L.A. area. So right. The one that I came across that I decided to discuss about this aviation disaster was something that happened on January 26, 2020.
Does that
date ring a bell for you at all?
January 2020, so before the pandemic.
Yes.
Before. Obviously. Oh, no, Kobe.
Yes, right. Yeah. That's correct.
Yeah.
So this was Kobe Bryant was in a helicopter that crashed in Calabasas, California, which is about 30 miles from downtown LA. He was on his way from John Wayne Airport to Camarillo Airport. All nine people who were on board the helicopter were killed. You have Kobe Bryant and his 13-year-old daughter, Gianna, a baseball coach, John Altobelli, and along with his wife and his wife, Carrie, and their daughter, Alyssa. Another person, Peyton Chester, and her mother, Sarah, were on the helicopter. and a basketball coach named Christina Mauser, along with the pilot. They were all killed in the crash. The helicopter apparently entered low cloud cover, which caused the pilot to lose his sense of orientation and therefore lost control of the helicopter, and it ended up crashing. This happened at 9:06 a.m. on the 26th.
Yeah, no, I do remember that day. It was super foggy all throughout L.A. on that day. And then, I remember hearing about that like that same day, and it just came as a shock to me and basically everybody.
Yeah,
I know. I mean, everybody knows Kobe. Sure. I mean, he was just a huge part of L.A.
Yeah,
just with the Lakers and everything else. Really, it was a horrible tragedy.
Yeah,
I mean, Kobe
sure.
was at the point where he didn't like to deal with traffic. Traffic is a huge part of just living in L.A., and he was of means that he could just take helicopters to avoid a lot of the traffic in the area.
That's correct. And, do you know how long it would have taken him to, if he drove from Newport Beach at his house to the Mamba Sports Academy, which is where
probably
he was
would have
on
taken
his way
him. Yeah, I mean, depending on traffic. I mean, at that time on a Sunday, that probably wouldn't have been so bad, but, you know, it would probably take about 45 minutes or so.
Okay, well, according to the research I did,
that.
Right, according to the research I did, it would have been a 2-hour drive for him.
Or 2 hours, so.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, again, this is the research I got. I've never driven from, you know, from that place to another. And the previous day, they also flew in a helicopter, and it took 30 minutes.
Huh.
So the idea was is he was able to basically shave off an hour and a half travel time by hiring a helicopter in order to take him.
Hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
It actually took a very long time before they were able to it took them 2 days to recover all the bodies.
Hmm.
And they actually were able to identify Kobe Bryant and three others through fingerprints, and then five of the others they needed to identify them via DNA testing, which means that the bodies weren't that recognizable, unfortunately, after such a crash.
Fire.
Yeah.
I mean, and there was a big controversy, of course, with that one because. You know, I believe that, you know, the authorities that were there were taking pictures and they were sharing them among themselves. And there was a big lawsuit. And I believe recently that Kobe Bryant's wife won that lawsuit and got a pretty large settlement.
Right. I mean, one of the complaints was that less than 2 hours after the crash, TMZ already confirmed Bryant's death. And they were criticized by the local law enforcement because the coroner's office hadn't yet confirmed any of the identities and didn't inform any of the families.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's not the type of thing you want to find out, on TMZ.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, one of the interesting things about the repercussions of some of this that happened in LA, shortly after this happened, suddenly there were billboards and murals that people had painted all across LA where it showed Kobe, was honoring Kobe and his daughter and the people that died. There were dozens and dozens of these that cropped up and still are around today. And
yeah.
It was a big shock.
Yeah, for sure. Very sad. So, Josh, do you want to tell us once again how we can find Josh Horowitz?
Well, you can find me at joshhorowitz.com. I'm also on the podcasts 12 Chimes, It's Midnight, as well as 5 Minutes of Bonsai and 5 Minutes of Trouble. So search them up. You can also find them on moviesbyminutes.com.
All right. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on my website, movierobminute.com. You can find me on Facebook, and you can find me on Twitter. So until tomorrow, yippee-ki-yay.
Yippee-ki-yay.
If you're fond of sand dunes and salty air, quaint little